FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for this week's bonus episode, where we gave you an update on Pablo Velez's case. I was joined in the episode by Lisa Bratt Martinez, and we broke down the state's response to Pablo's most recent appeal. That generated a lot of questions from you guys. And of course, as always, this has been this entire bonus in between seasons feels like it's been the West Memphis 3 season, because we have more West Memphis 3 news, which we're going to get to right after a break.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
First things first, Bob, we've got a tweet here from Damian Eccles. The prosecutor in our case, Keith Cressman, has now filed a motion asking the judge to refuse or request to test evidence in order to reveal the actual murderer. Arkansas continues to follow the path of corruption they set out on from the very beginning of this case. That was from the 8th. That was posted yesterday.
Yeah, so yesterday for us, which was Tuesday of this week, Cressman filed his response, and it's pretty discouraging. I read through it. I'll probably do a more detailed breakdown later. He did make the time-barred argument that we expect, which I think could be easily defeated, but he went kind of a different route with it. It's actually really, I mean, it reads very condescending, very plain language the way it was written, and essentially, his first several points are that Damian has no right to do DNA testing. He has no right to habeas corpus because he's not in prison anymore. And I don't know legally what the argument is against, for or against that. I know that people who have already been released from prison do DNA testing and get exonerated after they've already been released. It happens often. We're working on doing that with Ed 8's case. But the way he made it sound was that he wrote in there that the result of the DNA testing, were it to be favorable to Damian, would be that he would be ordered either a new trial or that he would be ordered resentencing. And I said, since he's already completed his sentence, because with the Alford plea that, you know, he pled guilty and they sentenced him to time served, so he's already completed his sentence, that it would be silly. I think he even put the word silly to ask to test this evidence.
From an unbiased point of view, does that seem like a legitimate argument?
It would seem like a legitimate argument if that's what Damian was looking for, but that's not what he's looking for. What he's looking for is to prove his actual innocence.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another, like, he has been, you know, he hasn't even been exonerated. He was just, all he got was a resentencing. The Alford plea was just a resentencing for a shorter sentence, and he's still guilty. What he's trying to prove is that he's actually innocent to be fully exonerated. It's wiped from his record, and hopefully the real killer put behind bars. So that's the beginning of the argument, is that, as he put it, it's ridiculous, it's silly for them to even ask for this testing, which, I mean, what you have to look at is the fact that a year ago, Cressman said he had no problem doing the testing. And then he said he straight up lied and said the evidence was gone. And now that we found out the evidence isn't gone, now he's acting like it was a silly request to begin with. I wish I could tell you legally, I'm sure I'll talk to some of Damien's attorneys here in the coming week or so and maybe get some more information. But I wish I could tell you whether that's an argument that can be easily defeated or not. I certainly hope so. And then moving forward, he says that a case review shows only two cases where MVAC was mentioned, and he doesn't know if MVAC is even an acceptable science, and says the court can't rule on whether or not the MVAC being new technology could allow for the testing unless they know if it's an acceptable science. Now, that I think could be easily proven, because MVAC technology has been through the Fry test in multiple occasions. So even if it wasn't necessarily used at trial, the Fry test, as I talked about with Jared Bradley when he was on the show, the Fry test is exactly that. It's to look for the judge to look and see if the MVEC technology is an accepted science. So that part shouldn't be too hard to overcome.
So is it only two cases, period, or is it just two cases in Arkansas that it's been used?
I don't know. He just says, it literally says a simple case law search only finds two MVEC times two when MVEC was mentioned in a case.
Interesting.
So I don't know how accurate that is. I know it's been used in more than two cases, so, and I know that it's been through Fry tests. And there's another test too, another standard that it's been through that Jared mentioned. I can't, the name's escaping me right now. And then the other one was that they think that the evidence, so it says that testing the evidence could destroy, completely consume and destroy any evidence that was there. And then he cites evidence preservation laws that say that you have to, you're required to maintain, which is pretty thick.
That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Right.
Why would he worry about the evidence being destroyed if he doesn't want them to test it at all?
Right. Yeah, so he says there shouldn't be allowed to test it, period. Secondly, he says that they shouldn't be able to test it because testing it could destroy the evidence and not leave any to be tested later, which is illegal because they're required to maintain the evidence. But the reason they're supposed to maintain the evidence is so that you can test it.
That's so asinine.
Yeah, it's a completely bass-ackwards argument. He's arguing against his own points. Maybe he's hedging by doing that. But he also doesn't understand the technology because another thing that he points out is there's two other defendants who aren't a part of the motion. And so, you know, they have a right for that evidence to be maintained. And if it's going to be completely consumed and destroyed by using the MVAC, then they wouldn't have an opportunity to test it later. But again, he's also arguing they should never have an opportunity to test it. But the way MVAC works, as it was broken down for me on the show when I was at Pure Gold's lab, is so instead of evidence would be destroyed with a standard method, right? Or would be consumed because they would take a swab and swab all over the item to pull up any available DNA, and then they would take that swab and run it through whatever machines they run it through to extract the DNA from it and analyze it, and then whatever DNA was there is gone. The way MVAC works is it sucks the evidence using the vacuum out of the item. So it would remove it from the item itself, but then it collects it in a disc that's the size of about a half dollar. So instead of a swab, it goes onto this big disc that's a filter that catches it. And then when they run it through to test it, they cut the disc into like fractions. And I think she said they cut it into like six wedges, and they'll test one wedge and then maintain it. It's actually a very good way of maintaining the evidence because then they'll preserve the rest of the filter that catches all the DNA in case there's better technology to do that part of it later on. So it won't destroy it. It will still preserve it, but it's just a weird argument. And then lastly, that he says, you know, he gets into the time barred issue. And he cites the 36-month presumed timeliness, as I mentioned several weeks ago. And he says they're outside of that, which, again, I think that is easily defeated by the fact that they claim the evidence didn't exist. You can't claim they should have tested it earlier when you were telling them that there was no evidence to test. He just completely ignores the fact that he lied about that. But then he says that the only way that he would be allowed to test it in a timely manner would be if it was to prove his actual innocence. So he sort of gives, the way I read it as a non-lawyer, he gives the argument against his argument in that point.
Yeah, he really seems like he's talking in circles the whole time.
Yeah, so he starts off by saying they have no right to test it. That's ridiculous. He doesn't want to get a new trial or a new sentence when he's already served his sentence. So he shouldn't be able to test it. And then later in the document, he says they are only allowed to test it if they're trying to prove their actual innocence, which is exactly what he's doing. And then he makes the argument that this testing would not prove his actual innocence.
Well, isn't the whole point of, you know, the one argument about preserving the evidence is in case any new form of testing comes along that they can test it,
mm-hmm.
which MVEC is a new form of testing.
Right.
So why I'm so confused about his whole argument.
Yeah, it's very confusing. Like when I first started reading, I was like, oh my God, that makes sense. Because he's saying you can't do, because like habeas corpus is Latin, it translates to show me the body or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, there is no body in prison. So why are we even talking about this, basically? And I was like, oh shit, that's a good point. But then I thought, well, I bet the lawyers thought of that before they made the motion to argue it. But then he comes back around and says, well, yeah, actually they can test it if they're trying to prove actual innocence. But we don't think this would prove their actual innocence. When the fact is, if they find someone else's DNA in those knots,
mm-hmm.
then it will, you know, if they don't find anything, or they don't find Damian, Jason, or Jesse's DNA in those knots, that's not going to exonerate them. As we've said before, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence in our court system. But what they're hoping to do is to find the actual killer's DNA, which would exonerate them. So it seemed to me like they've got a pretty good path forward. They can show through the Fry tests and the other case documents that it is an acceptable science. They may even have to do a Fry test in Arkansas. There's different, some states are Fry states. I can't remember the other standard. But that they would have to go through and prove that it is actually an acceptable science, and that it is. I think that if they can do that and prove that it is capable of proving their actual innocence and is also capable of preserving the evidence for later testing, I think if they can, then I think they've got a good shot of getting the testing if the judge, you know, is being objective and you know, wants to find some resolution to the case. I certainly hope that the judge would take into account the deception on the part of the defendant. I mean, for them to come out and straight up lie about the evidence being gone, and now that it's there, now they have arguments against it, it's a very clear pattern that they're trying to hide from.
I mean, that's the problem, though, is we really hope that they can be objective and see this, but they've proven in years past that they can't, that they just won't do it.
Well, the prosecutor, but the judges, on the other hand, I wish I could remember the name of the judges, but you know, there was a big fight about testing DNA back in the early 2000s, and it was a judge that ordered that the evidence could be tested. It was a judge that accepted the Alford plea. And if you remember, if you ever seen those video clips of when the Alford plea was put out, or was put on the record, that judge, you know, went out of his way to talk about what an injustice this was, and he was, you know, he said a lot of things he didn't need to say. So my hope is that there are some good judges in Arkansas that are going to be objective, even though it's very clear the prosecution is not. Oh, and there was another argument too, was that they filed the order for the motion for Crittenden County, and then they said something about the trial actually occurred in Craighead County. Craig, I think that was the name of it. But he says, you know, this error is fatal, is the way it was written in the, so I don't know exactly how that shakes out if they filed it in the wrong court. I would assume if that's the case, they could just refile it in the proper court if it was in the wrong court.
Seems like it.
But I think there's some confusion. So there must have been a change of venue from Crittenden County's prosecutor's office who prosecuted it, but that they prosecuted it in the Craighead County, like there was a change of venue or something. I don't remember how all that shook out, but. So that's where things stand with the West Memphis 3 case. The next step, I believe, is for Damian's team then to file a rebuttal, rebutting the state's letter, that their response that they put in.
Okay, moving on. Carrie says, how likely is it that Pablo Velez will be paroled next year? It seems like this is going to be his best hope of getting out, since the state is so ridiculous with their time limit rules.
I don't know. I don't think those time limit rules are going to stand up. I don't think the time barred issues that they're raising to me, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but it seemed very desperate to me the way the state approached it. The most encouraging part about it is that the state seemed to put all their eggs in one basket by arguing only that they're not allowed to argue the issues, but have not at all claimed that the corruption and the Brady violations and all of that actually occurred. So it seems like if the judge rules that that is not time barred and they are allowed to argue it, well, the state has not made any contention whatsoever that, you know, other than saying that they don't think some of the items were material, meaning it didn't affect the outcome of the trial, which is complete nonsense. You know, if the jury knew that Claudia Beltran not only didn't perfectly, cleanly, and 100% ID Pablo, but instead said it looked like him, but the hair was different. But if they also knew, if Claudia had testified, if they knew that Claudia had told the prosecutor that I saw the actual killer in the courtroom and it was definitely not Pablo Velez, to think that wouldn't have affected the jury is ridiculous. As far as parole goes, it's tough. I mean, we've seen it happen, obviously, with Ed Ates. You know, he was, as far as I know, still the only person in Texas that, you know, with a murder conviction that was paroled while maintaining his innocence. But that took a lot of work. I think Pablo probably would have a chance if he's able to get a good parole attorney to represent him and were able to present a case of innocence to the parole board, that he's probably got a chance to be paroled. But I'm still holding out. I'm hoping that that his current appeal makes it through.
Abby says, does getting parole require him to admit guilt or remorse? I remember this being a huge blocker for Ed Ates, and he was the first to get paroled while maintaining his innocence in Texas.
Yeah, like I said, it's typically they want to see what they're looking for is, have you been reformed? Are you showing remorse? Is there a concern about you reoffending after you get back out? There's more factors. Do you have a support network when you get out? There's a lot that goes into that. It's hard to say. I mean, whether Ed's case was a lightning strike and it's never going to happen again, or if it was a start of a new trend where the parole board is now actually considering that someone may not show remorse for doing something because some people truly are innocent. So, well, it's only time will tell.
Brian says, what can we do as individuals to help free Pablo? Is there any way we can help him get paroled, since it seems the powers that be don't want to see a free man get justice?
As individuals, I don't know right now what we can do, other than if you go to Pablo's website and click the links to the GoFundMe site, if we're able to help raise enough money to get him a good parole attorney, I think that's a good bet. You know, as far as the actual appeal, that's going to be, you know, at this point it's in the hands of the lawyers. But as a backup, if we're able to raise enough money to where they can get themselves a good attorney to help with the parole process, that could help as well.
Kathy says, what can we do to change the stupid time bar rule? Why is it even a thing? If there's ever evidence that proves justice wasn't served, shouldn't it be the responsibility of the courts to consider it?
I have a lot of questions about the time bar thing, and I think I know some of the answers, but it's a little confusing to me too. Is it more of a legal tactic, or is there a legitimate reason for the time bar?
There is a legitimate reason, and the problem we have is that we only work on wrongful conviction cases.
Okay.
And in most cases, like Pablo's, there's a very, it seems extremely obvious and clear that this person's innocent. So for us, it's like, this is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Why, when we find out that there was all this corruption and withholding of evidence and Brady violations, how can you hire in with Adnan's case with the cell phone evidence? You know, how can our system be so skewed that it doesn't allow them to raise those arguments?
It just seems like so often we see it. I do believe there's a legitimate reason for it, but it seems like so often that we see it, it's just some tactic that they're using. It doesn't seem like it's very legitimate reasoning behind it.
It's certainly an excuse they're using, and I think that you see it in cases like Pablo's, where the truth is very clear. The state doesn't have another argument. It's pretty well documented,
mm-hmm,
that they withheld all this evidence. They have no argument, so it's kind of like their only shot is to, which you know, takes us back to the morals and ethics of a prosecutor. Like, okay, yes, this might be your only shot to win,
mm-hmm,
but is this something? But is it a win? Is it a win for justice if you stop an innocent man from getting out of prison? But you know, coming out as far as the reason for it. The reason for it is we only have so many judges, so many courtrooms, so many lawyers, so much time and resources to put into these appeals. So our system is set up to really protect what they call the finality of justice. It's set up so that if you're convicted, that that conviction is final unless there's a really good reason to bring it back, the conviction back up and to question it. So the time barred issues are put in where they're saying, look, if you have new evidence, you need to bring it out. You can't keep coming back to the well over and over and over and over and over again, because there's just as many guilty people appealing their cases as there are innocent people all the time. So it's there is a reason for it. But in our case, in a case like this, it's terrible. Like Adnan's case is the perfect example. You know, there's legitimate reason that even the judge ruled was enough to overturn his conviction. And then another judge says, yeah, but yes, that overturns the conviction. And they even said in their opinion that they believe that it would have changed the outcome of the trial had the jury known this. It was clearly ineffective assistance of counsel, and he deserves a new trial. But he waited too long to make the argument, so he has to stay in prison. And it's awful. As far as changing, I don't know. It's so hard. The issue is, it's so difficult to legislate for everything. You know, a good example of that is people that'll argue about the death penalty. They'll be like, oh, you know, I can show you actual real life examples where innocent people were put to death. It was proven later they were innocent. So people will say, well, yeah, that is terrible. So, but you know, I still think the death penalty is a good thing. Maybe we can put in a rule that you can only get the death penalty if you're sure there's no way to make a standard that can apply to all circumstances with legal language. So that's why, like, in my position on the death penalty, first of all, I don't think it accomplishes anything. I don't think it's definitely not cheaper. It definitely ends up taking more time because they get more appeals if they have a death sentence. And I don't think killing the person is any worse punishment than leaving them in prison for the rest of their life. But beside that, to me, my position on the death penalty is very easy, because it's very simple. If there's any possibility, if there's any chance that you're going to murder someone, that you can dish out a penalty that can't be taken back, and there's a possibility that that could happen to one single innocent person, then it shouldn't be an option. We shouldn't, if we have a fallible system that can get it wrong and oftentimes does get it wrong, then we should not have a penalty even on the table that you can't undo. And it's bad enough when somebody loses 10, 15, 20, 25 years of their life before they get out and get proven innocent, but at least they're still alive and have a fighting chance.
Lori says, if I were a juror and I got to hear what really happened, I'd be beyond pissed and feel duped by the prosecution. Have you ever had any jurors reach out to you after they've heard additional facts and an objective presentation on any of the cases that you've covered?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I had a juror at one point that didn't want to be interviewed or be on the record at all, from the West Memphis 3 case, actually, that reached out and was just shocked to hear the evidence and how things really shook out. But I have spoken to jurors that I reached out to. In Ed 8's case, I was able to talk to several jurors. And in that case, most of them were just appalled. I still remember the one woman just bawled her eyes out on the podcast when I told her about the actual facts of the case and what they missed. She was devastated that she had sent him away, and she had said what really upset her was that the judge had dynamited the jury, meaning he forced them when they said they were deadlocked three times, and the judge forced them to continue deliberating, and she was one of the holdouts. She was one of the final two that refused to vote guilty, and I remember still I asked her, I'm like, well, Thursday night at 6 o'clock, you said not guilty. And the foreman told the judge you were deadlocked. And then Friday morning at 9 a.m., you said guilty. What changed overnight? And she just cried and said nothing changed. They said they were going to sequester us over the weekend. There was so much pressure. Everybody was mad at me for holding out. So I finally just caved and went with them. And then she realized that she sent an innocent man to prison for 20 years because of it. But then you have the flip side of that. You've got the jury foreman from Sandy Melgar's case who refused to hear the truth. And then we find out when 2020 was on that case, he was having a viewing party with the prosecutor He was like best buddies with her. There's some people think maybe before the trial, which nobody's been able to prove, but certainly after the trial that they were best buddies, and he got involved in the Facebook groups and the podcasts that were fighting against Sandy's guilt. So it kind of goes either way. They're just, you got to remember, jurors are just like anybody else. You have a whole cross section of society. Some people that are really open and honest and want to find the truth, and then other people who are just, you know, narcissists that refuse to admit they were ever wrong.
All right, our last question is from Chris. Since y'all have decided that you need another month to launch the new season, can I sign up to have Zach Weaver's grandpa just be on standby for follow-ups? Can we just hang out with him again about Kennedy or aliens or whatever he wants to talk about this week?
Is Grandpa Doug into aliens?
I don't think he's into aliens, but he would talk about it for sure. Yeah, he could talk about anything. That means
we'll have to set up another bonus episode with your grandpa.
It would be a lot of fun. He could talk about anything. I think he would talk about aliens. I don't think he's into aliens. I don't think that's it. But I think he's, you know, working for NASA. I think he believes in there's life out there, not little green Martians.
Sounds good. We need to resurrect Bob and Weave and have him on there.
I would love it. I would absolutely love it. It was a blast having him on, and I think he'd come back.
Nice. So we'll work on that. But speaking of guests, next week, as I mentioned to you guys, we're kind of pushing things back because of a couple of conflicts. One is I can't give you any details other than sometime this year there's going to be something on Hulu talking about one of the cases we've covered in the past. And I have to film for that this month. So that's why, you know, part of the reason we're pushing things back. And then next week, Mike is going to be out on assignment for the whole week. He's leaving us. So you need to know a couple of things from that. One, next week's follow-up, our good friend of the show, Janet Varney, is going to fill in for Mike. So she will be the Mike for the day. We will be doing another YouTube live with that episode. So if you're not already subscribed to our YouTube channel, go subscribe and turn on notifications. You should get a notification when we go live. It'll be next Wednesday. It'll be me, Zach, and Janet. Also, you should know that the audio for both next week's main episode and next week's follow-up are probably going to sound pretty damn bad because I'm I'm going to be editing them, and I don't remember how to edit. So
good luck.
You'll be okay.
Yeah. So Mike always asks me well in advance if it's okay if he takes a week vacation for his assignment. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then the time comes up and I remember that I'm probably not nearly as good at making stuff sound good as Mike is. So
thanks, Bob.
Yeah, no problem. Mike's very good at his job and I'm not good at Mike's job, but we'll figure it out. We'll make it happen. And then again, don't forget that I will be at CrimeCon. We're working out details, but it's I'm pretty excited about, I'm going to be speaking at least twice. One of them I can tell you is we're going to do a true crime binge live with Justin and Aaron from the Generation Y podcast. So we'll be doing that during CrimeCon. And then there's going to be one of the big ballrooms, a big presentation it'll be about the West Memphis 3 case. I can tell you that. Incredibly interesting topic with an incredibly interesting guest that's going to be up there with me. If you want to go to CrimeCon, use our code RUFF. And again, that'll get you 10% off. It also, if we get enough people using the code, then Zach gets to come with me.
I hope I get to go.
Yeah, I think we're getting there. I need to reach out and see how, because just for based on social media, it looks like we've had a lot of people using the code. So
I had a lot of fun last year, and it was fun meeting all the listeners, and I'd love to do it again.
Yep. So I think that's probably, I think we're getting there. I think that'll probably work out. So if you want Zach to go to Las Vegas, go to crimecon.com, use code RUFF for us. It only works for standard tickets. It doesn't work for VIP tickets. I've mentioned to a few people on social media, people have asked if it's worth getting the VIP tickets. I don't really know. I will tell you this. In my experience at CrimeCon, they're like the VIPs have like a special VIP room where they get to go into that has like coffee and snacks and stuff in it. And what I often see is like one or two VIPs just like sitting in that room by themselves because they can, because they paid an extra $300 or whatever to be in there. Meanwhile, everybody else is out on the floor hanging out with all the podcasters, having fun during that time. There is also, I think you get, the VIPs get like a special like dinner and special event, which I've been to. is, you know, it was the one we did. You were there for that one, Mike, when we did the one in Nashville with Jim.
Yep.
And it was a good time, but even we had some FOMO while we were there because all the other podcasters were doing a huge meetup at the same time and hanging out with people and having a good time. So since then, I've stopped going. I don't go to the VIP dinner parties because usually myself and Mike or Zach, whoever's with me, and Nick and Captain and Justin and Aaron. And shoot, last year, I can't even remember, about 25 of us podcasters all went to a bar with a bunch of listeners and hung out there. So long story short, personally, I think you'd be better off saving your money, not getting the VIP tickets. If what you're looking to do is to not just meet or take a picture with, but actually hang out with the podcasters that you listen to, just get a standard ticket and follow us around. We're always doing something fun while you're there. But again, remember, if you go, we make sure you use code RUFF to get that 10% off. Coming up the next couple of weeks, we've got, for bonus episodes, we've got three cool interviews lined up. Next week, I've got a cop that helped frame and wrongfully convict someone who has kind of reconciled with that with that person and is here coming on to share some insight into what causes that culture within the police department to cause things like that to happen. I also have a man who has spent some time in prison and speaks out a lot on criminal justice reform. So that'll be coming up in 2 weeks, I think. And then this week on Sunday, in just 2 days, we have a very special guest. I'm very excited to have her on the show. I have Kelsey German coming on the show, who is, for those of you that don't know, is Libby German's sister. And Libby German is one of the victims of the Delphi murders. And she's going to be on. Saturday is actually the anniversary, the 5-year anniversary date of Abby and Libby's murders. And Kelsey is kind enough to come on the show with me and talk about her experiences as a family member of a victim and what life has been like for those last 5 years. That'll be this Sunday.
That'll be a really good one. I'm excited to hear that one.
Yep. With that being said, make sure you tune in this week in 2 days to hear Kelsey's interview. And then next week, don't forget YouTube Live with myself, Zach, and Janet Varney in next week's follow-up episode. And that's all we've got coming up right now, so make sure to tune in on the live. Hopefully we'll see you in the live chat. We'll talk to you then. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd really like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, Truth and Justice Pod. Just click the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at @BobRuffTruth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING, and Zach is @Z2TheQ.
And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I can't.
Well, that was too thing. That was too heavy.
I'm a little hot with that.
That was a little too heavy.
A little much. I'll give you that.
Welcome back.